Okay, welcome to the fourth lecture for CS162. So our topic today is going to be thread dispatching. So we're going to learn all about threads, how they work, and then how to switch from one thread to another thread, and some of the different mechanisms for doing that switch. Okay, so just a quick review of what we talked about last Wednesday. We were talking about multiple processes with multiple threads. So remember, the definition of what a process is it's the operating system abstraction that represents everything that we need to run a single multi-threaded program. Okay, there's two parts here now. One part is the multiple threads, each of which is a single sequential thread of execution. So we're just running some program in sequence, and we could have multiple threads that are running the program code in sequence. And that's the active part. Then there's the passive part, which is the protected resource. And this is things like the address space and the I/O state. All right? Those are the only things that can affect the process, is the address space and the I/O state. And those are the only things that the process can affect. So this is what gives us the protection boundary between multiple processes. Then you can ask the question, why do we separate threads from processes? And there's a couple of reasons. One is that we can have multiple threads in a single process if we're not looking at heavyweight processes. And the second thing is that then we can talk about the concurrency separately from talking about the protection that's being provided by the address space. So it's really just abstraction. If we look at something like an old-style Unix process, a heavyweight process, then that's just what we would call one of our current processes, these lightweight processes, plus one thread, or with only one thread, I should say. All right, so here's a picture that just shows that. The threads are encapsulating the concurrency here on the right. We have a single shared code, data, and files in both cases, but in the case of the heavyweight process, we just have a single set of registers and a single stack frame, a set of stack frames. In the case of the multi-threaded process, we have individual registers and stacks for each of those threads. So each thread has its own private registers, own private stack. Again, threads are active, the address space is passive, and gives us the firewall between multiple processes. So if this process crashes, it won't affect any other processes, it won't affect the operating system. Okay, then again, remember that we can divide up operating systems into two sets of categories. Either they provide a single address space or multiple address spaces, and we either have a single thread or multiple threads per address space. Up in the left here, we have MS-DOS and early Macs. Down below here, we have multiple threads in a single address space. So typically embedded systems, things like the Palm Pilot and Java operating systems. In the many address spaces but single threaded is that traditional Unix with its heavyweight process. And then finally, we have all the other modern operating systems which give us the best of both worlds. Multiple threads in an address space and multiple simultaneous address spaces. Okay. So, for today, we're going to talk about threads in more detail. After today, you should understand everything there is to understand about the structure and operation of threads, except we won't do the early part of thread creation. That'll come in the next lecture. We're also going to talk about thread dispatching. So we're going to use thread dispatching is basically how we select the next thread that we're going to run, or rather, how we run the next thread that's been selected to run. What we'll talk about later on in the term is how we pick amongst a set of threads which one we should run next. So this is going to be the mechanism of running the next thread. Later on will be the policy, which is to select which thread to run next. And we'll just get a little bit into thread scheduling. Okay, so remember, this is what an execution stack looks like. We've got some program text over here, a procedure A that calls, depending on the value of the local variable, calls either B or just simply prints the value that it was called with. And then B calls C, and C calls A with a particular value. And we're going to start off the program with the value of temp equal to 1 as an argument. So this is the stack set of stack frames that get created. The stack grows from high to low and starts with the local variables here, and we see each frame appearing with the return program counter being stored on the stack, so we know where to return when we come back from C, where does B return back to? It returns back to this point. Okay, this is a fundamental abstraction. You should be very familiar with this. The challenge we're going to face is we have to fit multiple of these growing things into a single address space when we have a multi-threaded program. Okay, another concept to remember is we have register files, or register sets on a processor. So this is for the MIPS processor, which is what you're going to use in Nachos. And you can see we have 32 registers, and not all registers are equal. Some registers have different functions. So for example, register 0 is always a 0. Now, why would I want to have a register which the only thing it ever stores is 0? I can't write it. I can only read it. I mean, yeah. I don't know what 0 is. What do you mean by that? Right, I don't know how it's represented. So certainly this would give me an example. If I wanted to load 0, I could simply just copy the value out of register 0. Yeah. Right. I don't also have to keep reloading the immediate 0. So if I want to do a comparison, for example, of something against 0, rather than having to load it as part of an instruction, I can simply say, compare this flag to register 0. Compare this other register to register 0. And that gives me an easy way of doing a comparison to test, is this equal to 0? Okay, there's another register AT, which is the assembler temporary register. So the assembler can play around with the code that's generated by the compiler. And this just gives it a register to have that flexibility. Other registers are reserved also, like K0 and K1, registers 26 and 27. Some registers have special meanings. So for example, a pointer to the heap area is 28, a pointer to the stack is 29, to the current frame on the stack is 30. 31 is our return address, so the return program counter we keep in 31. And then there are two other sets, the set in blue and the set in red, and actually there's a third set, the set in green. The set in blue is when I make a call into a procedure, I provide the arguments. So if they're small arguments, integer arguments, 32 bits, then I can fit them, up to four of them, in registers 4 through 7. The other last two sets are registers T and registers S0 through S7 and T0 through T9. And these registers are saved either by the caller or the callee. Right? So registers that the caller has to save means that the callee can clobber these registers. So when I call into procedure B can feel free to use registers T0 through T9. Okay? Doesn't have to save them, doesn't have to restore them, it can do whatever it wants. However, for registers 16 through 23, if it modifies these registers, B has to save the value before it modifies them. And then before I return through the return address, I have to return those registers back to their original values. Now, what happens if I don't recognize this discipline for using registers? Yeah. Right, exactly. So if I don't save registers and I modify them, then I could, you know, if I'm modifying these S registers, then I could affect the behavior of the procedure that called me. Okay, and if I modify some of these other ones, I could cause the entire process to fail. So it's very important to make sure that we maintain the proper discipline when we're calling from one procedure to another. We're going to have the same problem when we go from one thread to another thread. We're going to have to ensure that we preserve all 32. Yes?
Is there actually some sort of internal recipe that comes towards these conventions, or if it's a single-threaded process that you're running, would it matter if you're using certain registers the way you're not supposed to use?
Okay, so that's a very good question. So the question was, is there a single mechanism that enforces this discipline? And, well, what if we have a single-threaded program? Does it actually matter that we use this discipline? I'll turn that around. Does someone want to answer that? So first of all, is there some mechanism that enforces this? Yeah. Is there something that enforces this? Yeah. The compiler. So the compiler will generate code that enforces this discipline. If you handwrite code, then it's up to you to make sure you enforce it. There is no underlying mechanism that's going to say, ah, you forgot to save this register, except that your program will occasionally fail in very bizarre and hard to debug ways. So first part, no, there's no discipline. Now, what if we only have a single-threaded program? Do we actually need to follow this particular discipline? Yes? Right, so this program is calling itself. We want to make sure that it has some discipline. Now, it might not necessarily have to be this discipline. It just has to have some discipline. But in reality, even if you're writing a single-threaded program, you're likely going to link in with library functions. Well, guess what? The library functions are going to follow exactly this discipline. So if you don't actually follow this discipline, things may work now, but then someone goes and relinks your program with a new version of the library and everything breaks. So it's best to follow whatever the discipline is for the particular architecture. Yeah, question? That's correct. This is just one policy. Other hardware architectures will even provide basically registers that are on a thread basis. So then when you're switching between them, you don't have to worry about swapping. In this case, we only have a single set of registers, so we have to make sure we swap them completely, and we have to make sure we follow the discipline internally to a thread. Yeah. That's right. This really only is important if you're handwriting MIPS. But the main reason why I wanted to use this example is because we're going to have to follow a different discipline when we go from thread to thread. Okay, any other questions? Okay. So before we call, we have to save the caller saves registers, so the T0 through T9. We'll save V0 and V1. These are just temporary registers. And we'll save the return address. And then after the return, the callee save registers should be correct, if the callee correctly saved them before making changes. And these registers should have been restored. Now, when we call in, these registers may actually get changed by that thread, but the thread should undo those changes, method or procedure should undo those changes before return. Like the stack pointer may have grown or changed. Same thing with the frame pointer will definitely change. And then anything else potentially has been trashed. So the argument variables may have been trashed, and other things that we can't refer to also may have changed transparently to us, but we're not supposed to be using those anyway. Okay, so let's look at a single-threaded example. So let's say we have the following program. We're going to compute digits of pi and output them to the file pi.txt. And, you know, we want to figure out who actually made it into this class of 120-odd students. So we're going to print that out to this clist.txt file. So what's the behavior here? What is our pi.txt going to contain, and what's our clist.txt going to contain when we run this program? Yeah. Exactly. So we'll be in week 15 and we still won't know who's in the course. Because the compute pi subroutine that we call here is going to run infinite. Right? There's an infinite number of digits of pi, so we'll just keep printing digits of pi. We'll never actually figure out who's in the class. This method, that procedure will never actually get invoked. Okay, so what we can do instead is use threads. So now we have a version of the program looks exactly like the previous one, except it's got these method calls or procedure calls for create thread. And we're providing as an argument the actual thing that we want to run. So the question now is what does create thread actually have to do? Well, it has to start an independent thread that runs this particular given procedure. And what should be the behavior here now? Assuming we have non-blocking calls, yeah. Yes.
So
Right. So after some finite period of time, our class list will contain the file will contain the class list, and our pi file will contain some digits of pi. So what'll happen though is if you were observing each file independent, let's say you were tailing a file, you'd see a little bit of a few digits of pi printing out, and then a few lines of the class file, a few digits of pi, a few lines of the class file. Because what's happening under the cover is we're multiplexing our physical CPU as if we had two CPUs. So we're just multiplexing it in time. So first we run a little bit of thread one, then a little bit of thread two, then a little bit of thread one, then a little bit of thread two, a little bit of thread one, a little bit of thread two. Time marches forward. Okay. Now, yes, question? That's a good question. Do I need the second create thread? Yeah, strictly speaking, no. Assuming main is running in a thread, running compute pi in a separate thread, they would both run together. So you don't have to have both create threads. Okay, so let's see what this looks like if we look at the memory footprint. Yeah, yes, question? Yes. So in this case, there actually are three threads. Main will actually end and exit, and then the two children threads will keep running. So in fact, there would actually be CPU1, CPU2, CPU3, which would be the main thread ending, and then it would be just CPU1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2. Okay? Yeah. Yes, parent thread can terminate at any time. You'll see later on, we actually maintain a separate state for things that have terminated because it might have children, and we want to keep track of that. So this is like on a Unix system, if you ever see, you do a PS, and you see a process that's Z, it's zombied because it's either a parent or it's a child waiting for the other one to finish, and one is waiting on the other, and you need to have something there so you know what you're waiting on. We'll see this, I think, later on in this lecture. Okay, so let's see what this looks like actually in memory. So if we were to stop the program, look at it under the debugger, we would see two sets of CPU registers. We would see two sets of stacks. So here, for example, is stack 2. Here's stack 1. Now, there's a couple of questions. One is, where do we put the two stacks? Okay, so I drew them, you know, stack 1 all the way at the top of our address space and stack 2 somewhere down. So how far down should stack 2 be from stack 1? Any ideas? What's that?
Arbitrary.
Yeah, it is kind of arbitrary. We have to pick some spot, okay, and we have to kind of move it down. Another question is, what are the maximum sizes that we should choose for the stacks? How do we pick the maximum stack size? Some arbitrary distance. So one of the things we could do is we could look at our program and look at how much recursion we expect and look for, and this is something that actually just hit one of my grad students, look for temporary variables that are stored on the stack. And here's a clue. If you write C programs, they tend to, and you do printfs, the static buffer for printf gets stored on the stack in a lot of implementations. And that can be like 2K in size. So if you're doing lots and lots of printfs or other things, you have to be careful because your stacks can grow to be very large. Now, what happens if the threads violate this? If this stack keeps growing, it grows right into stack 2. Stack overflow. What happens when I have a stack overflow? An exception. Unfortunately, not. Yeah. So that's an interesting question. Depending on how we lay out our stacks, we may be able to use a virtual memory system to detect when we've run off of the end of the stack by marking the pages as, say, invalid. But if we've got a lot of threads, we may not have enough address space to basically allocate enough space between the stacks to be able to do that. So if we can't do something like leverage off the hardware, what's going to happen when stack 1 goes careening through stack 2? Yeah. Right. It's going to overwrite the stack, and when thread 2 eventually returns back to the top of its stack, it's going to find garbage. And so random stuff is going to happen. It's exactly what, unfortunately, was happening to my grad student who kind of trashed his laptop in the process. So you have to be really careful. You know, maintaining this separation is pretty important. Like we started to talk about, one way to catch it would be if we can configure things such that stacks line up perfectly with page boundaries and everything, then we can use the virtual memory hardware to help us. But it gets to be very expensive. What's another way we could do it if we didn't have hardware? Hardware is expensive to use sometimes. So how else could we detect that we're overrunning stacks? Any suggestions? Yeah. Right. Okay, so we can define an endpoint for the stack. When our stack pointer passes it, that's an error. But how do we detect that we've passed the endpoint? Yeah. Count the number of stack frames. Yeah. So what we could do is we could add basically code so that when we're accessing the stack, we make sure we haven't violated this constraint of the maximum size of the stack. But the downside is that's going to be expensive. Because now, maybe not every time we access the stack pointer, but for some percentage of the time that we're accessing the stack pointer, we're going to have to ensure that our frames aren't growing beyond the end of the stack. This is also a huge security bug. A lot of the bugs in Windows where people are able to take over control of your machine are stack overruns, where you're basically able to cause the stack to overrun. Not into another stack frame, but you're able to break the discipline that's used for maintaining stack frames. Okay, so what state do we have to maintain per thread? So each thread is going to have this thread control block, and in the thread control block, we're going to have the execution state. So this is the CPU registers, the stack pointers, frame pointers, program counters, all of that, floating point registers. We're going to have scheduling information. So this will be stuff like what state is the thread in, and we're going to talk about this on the next slide, I think it is, the priority for the thread, and how much CPU time it's already used. Anything we're going to need to do the bookkeeping for scheduling policies. There's also accounting information. And this is mainly used, again, for scheduling, but on some machines you actually get, like supercomputers, you get billed for CPU time. Various pointers. So it could be we'll see this in a moment, what scheduling state are we in, what scheduling queue are we on currently. There will be a pointer to the enclosing process or its process control block. Who owns us? This also gives us a pointer indirectly to the address space information and maybe process ID and things like that. Other stuff that we might have in here, the thread ID, thread name, you know, other kinds of access control rights, capabilities, that sort of stuff. Anything you can think of. Yeah. Process control block. So that's the equivalent to the thread control block, but for the process. So that would contain pointers to the threads or the thread identifiers for the process. It would contain the address space information, and so on. Maybe the owner, user ID, that kind of stuff. So in Nachos, thread is just a class, and it includes the thread control block in it. Now, the operating system keeps track of these thread control blocks, and it keeps them in protected memory because it contains sensitive information, and so we want to control access to the TCBs. It could either be in an array or it could be in a linked list. And we'll see examples of linked lists. So here's the life cycle of a thread or even of a process has mirrors kind of the same life cycle. So first, a thread starts out in the new state. This is where we're creating it. We're just instantiated. We've created a thread control block. We're filling in the fields of the thread control block. Now, once we're done with that, it gets admitted into the system, and it's in the ready state, which means it's waiting to run. Okay, it's all set. As soon as you give it the CPU, it'll be executing instructions and happen. So eventually, it will get dispatched, and it will get a hold of the CPU, and now it's executing instructions. At some point, it'll do some I/O, let's say, and that'll cause it to be interrupted and go on to the ready queue. Or maybe a timer interrupt occurs, puts us back on the ready, in the ready state. We sit in the ready state. Eventually, we get scheduled again. We get to run. We get interrupted again. Go back into the ready state. I get scheduled again, run for a while. Eventually we do some I.O. or some other event occurs, and we go into waiting. So we might be waiting for another thread to finish. We might be waiting for I.O. from a device. Might be waiting for a user to type some character, so on. And eventually that completes, and we go back to the ready state. And again, we'll get scheduled, we run some more, get interrupted, runs, go back to ready, scheduled, run some more, and eventually we exit. And now we're in the terminated state. Now, when we go into the terminated state, there still is a lot of housekeeping and cleanup that has to be done. So we'll put the thread into the terminated state rather than simply just deleting it when it exits. And this way, if anybody's waiting on it or we're waiting on someone, we can clean up all of those dangling references. Now, active threads are represented by the... So as soon as they go from the new to the admitted state, they're represented by this thread control block, and we're going to organize them into queues based upon their state. So rather than simply setting a state variable in the thread control block, we're going to put the thread control block in a particular queue. Yes, question? Yeah, it could be anything that interrupts us. It could be some hardware generates an interrupt event, like the mouse movement generates an interrupt to provide the new values, a packet comes in from the network, a timer goes off, anything could cause a hardware interrupt. Yes? Yes, absolutely. If we have something computationally intensive going on, and you're moving the mouse or getting lots of packets in from the network or doing any, you know, anything that's going to generate I.O. events, then yes, that's going to take and cause overhead. And if you remember from last lecture, the context switch, you know, we go from running something to kind of save all the registers, load all the new registers, go back out of the kernel, run that code, then come back, you know, we're going back and forth. Those operations, that's all overhead. So that we pay a high cost. Okay, so let's look at the actual queues. So we start out with the thread not running. It's sitting on some scheduler queue, and there are going to be separate queues for each device or signal condition, and then there also will be queues that have different scheduler policies. So here's a picture. So we start out with we have the ready queue, we have tape unit, disk unit, and Ethernet. And each one of these has some thread control blocks. So here we have threads 9, 6, and 16. The tape device, there's nothing waiting on it. The disk, we've got two things waiting on it, threads 2 and 3. Second disk unit, nothing waiting. And then on the network, we have one thread, thread 8, that's waiting. Now, here's where it gets interesting. When it comes to I.O. devices, typically the only way you leave the queue is when you get a completion event. So, for example, thread 3 might have said, read some block. Okay? Thread 2 might have said, write some block. So when those blocks complete, that's when thread 2, say when it's write completes, it would then get moved on to the ready queue. From the ready queue, the policy now comes into play for scheduling. How do we select the next thread that we're going to pull off of this queue? It could be that we just use it FIFO, you know, which one came in first. And then, or it might be something else. You know, this is my process, and my process is more important, so it gets to run first. Or maybe it's that computationally intensive task, and we want to give that all the CPU, or a larger fraction of the CPU. Okay, so, yeah. Yes. Yes, so the question was, in things like Windows XP, you can go to the task manager and you can change the priorities for different processes. And that is changing how things are pulled off of this ready queue and put onto the CPU. Okay. Same thing if you look at on Unix, it's nice. So if you give something a negative nice value, then that will give it more CPU. Positive nice value, I think it is less CPU. And there's all sorts of, we'll look at in gory detail many different mechanisms for selecting what's going to be the next thread that gets lucky enough to get the CPU. Okay, so administrative stuff. We have podcasts. Audio podcasts are now available in many different forms. There's an RSS feed. You can use it with your favorite RSS feed grabber. There's stream versions if you want to listen to it online, and you can even manually download individual MP3 files for all of the lectures. The video also you can stream. I don't think you can download that. We have group assignments. We were able to give everybody, but I think three groups, their first choice. So like I said, you know, if everybody's good, then you know, the system will work. It turns out that we had only a few people that wanted to be in the 3-4 slot. So we now have a new time for section 106. So if you were scheduled into 106, what we did is we had 43 people that wanted the 2-3 slot, and so we actually created two separate sections. One will meet in Corey Hall in the Hogan Room. That's on the fifth floor. The room number is on the website. And every Tuesday except for 2-7, when it'll be over in Soda Hall in the Waz. And all the other times remain the same. So please check the website. There's a link which you can click to see what your section assignment is and start attending that starting tomorrow. Yes? So the question was, why not have discussion Wednesday instead? Because it was hard enough to get this scheduling done. I mean, mainly it's a balancing act. We were able to fit everybody but three groups into their first choice. And so that's why we did this. We could have kept the existing time slot, but we would have had to push a number of people forcibly into that slot. Any other questions about the section assignments? Okay. Sections are mandatory, so do make sure you attend them. And occasionally, your TA may take attendance. Okay, so time to start looking at nachos. If you haven't already, I'll say it again, please download the tar file and take a look at it. If you haven't downloaded it recently, we're updating the tar file because we now do have Java 1.5 support. We've fixed the problem with assert, and we've also fixed the problem with class instantiation. Yeah, question.
So we didn't assert any special
compile flags? No. No special compile flags needed anymore. It should run out of the box with 1.5. If it does not, let us know. We believe it will work fine with phase one. We're still testing with phase two, three, and four of the projects. But it should work, yeah.
Which JVM will you be using for testing?
JVM 1.5. So currently, I think the autograder is configured to use 1.31. We'll change it so the accounts by default right now, your path includes 1.3.1. We'll change it so your path automatically includes 1.5. So you shouldn't have to change it if you're using instructional machines. The reader. So all 450-odd pages worth of reader are at Copy Central now. And as soon as I know when they'll have it available, I'll let you guys know. Obviously, it'll take them a while to print that much. Yeah. I think it's the one down on like Hurst and Euclid. I'm pretty sure it's that one. I will verify that, though. It's kind of an interesting aside. 450 pages. When I was a postdoc at Xerox Palo Alto Research Center, a place where they invented laser printers, they have some amazingly fast laser printers. 180 pages or images per second, or per minute rather. they are working on the how you get to 180 pages per second. But the amazing thing is you can literally print books on demand. You feed the printer not with ordinary reams of paper, but rather these large paper carts that have about this much paper on them. And these banks use these, and credit card companies, and other places where they have like a million accounts, and they have to produce a million account, print out a million accounts each month. I don't think they have those kind of printers at Copy Central, so it may take them a little bit longer to make copies. Yeah. Yeah, so it just went down this morning. I should put it this way. It went down to the third floor of SOTA today, and the person who's responsible for it for the department is supposed to be sending it out. And I think this is like the first one that they're doing, so we'll see how the process goes. But please don't try and print all 450 pages. I did the lectures four up, double-sided, and they're still over 200 pages. But this has all the lectures, all the printouts, all the code, everything for the class. It also has the Java walkthrough. Yeah.
Which version of code?
So the only difference, it's like a two-line change to support 1.5, and then it's just we're replacing assert with nachos assert, since assert's a reserved keyword. Otherwise, the code is identical. If you haven't already been prompted for a passphrase, you should be prompted for a passphrase at some point, because now that we have groups, we need to create group accounts, and to do that, we need SSH keys. So what will happen is you'll get prompted to enter a passphrase. You enter a passphrase that will create an SSH private key, public key, protect your private key, please. The public key will then be swept by the instructional people and used to create your group accounts. If you forget your passphrase, you'll have to reset it. If you reset your public key, you'll have to then let us know so we can have instructional install your public key. So we're going to need this. Oh, one question I had is, how many people have used CVS or Subversion or some version control? Okay, if you're not familiar with CVS, I would recommend that you read the various CVS walkthroughs. You should do this class under CVS. It's a lot of code. It's about 183 pages of two-up code. So it's a non-trivial amount of code. And when you make changes, and it's 4 o'clock in the morning, and something breaks, it's really nice to be able to do a CVS diff and see what changes you made. So if you don't put it under CVS, you'll find it kind of a nightmare. CVS makes this class a lot easier. So if you're not familiar with CVS, your TAs will go over it in section, but also read the notes that are online. If you haven't run the register program, stop control C-ing and run the register program, because we need your name and everything for the roster. Okay, so we'll take a 3-minute break and start up at 10 of.
Thank you.
Okay, let's start back up. So I forgot to add it to the administration slide, but I won't have office hours tomorrow. So no Tuesday, 1 to 2 office hours. Unfortunately, I have to go out of town. I will be back just in time for class, hopefully, on Wednesday, but I will not be around tomorrow. If you need to meet with me, send me an email and we'll set up some alternate time. Okay, so let's talk about dispatching. So thread dispatch. So conceptually, what the operating system is doing is it's running the following loop. Run thread, choose the next thread to run, save the state of the CPU, and load the state of the CPU from a new thread control block. One thing you might notice is that this is an infinite loop. And basically, this is what an operating system does. It sits there all the time in an infinite loop. It's sort of like the read eval print loop of Lisp or Scheme. Basically, we just loop, running threads, choose the next thread to run, swapping state, and repeating. Do we ever exit this loop? Yes. I hear someone. When would we exit this loop? Yeah. Shutdown. Okay, yeah. Shutdown definitely will cause us to exit this loop. What else might cause us to exit this loop? Kernel panic, yes. Error, blue screen of death. We exit this loop. But otherwise, this loop is going to run continuously. Okay, so let's go through the steps that's in this. So when we run a thread, we load its state. So this is the registers, the program counter, the stack pointer into the CPU. And we load the environment, so this is the virtual memory space, whatever. This is if we're switching processes, threads across processes. If we're just switching from one thread to the other, then we don't have to load the address space. And then we're going to jump to the program counter. Now, to go back to my analogy, CPU program, computers are unpredictable, like people. And so, the CPU is basically like the single body that we're sharing with multiple personalities. If you've seen the movie Sybil, this was written by a computer developer or designer or something. Basically, we're going to switch from one personality, gets a hold of the CPU, gets to run, and at some point we're going to voluntarily or involuntarily switch to a different personality, and so on. So this is the steps we're going to go through of going from personality A to personality B. Now, the way the dispatcher gets control back to select the next lucky thread is either voluntarily, the thread says, I'm done, or I'm temporarily done, you can have the CPU back, I'm going to be a nice guy, nice citizen, or some external event occurs that causes the thread to get preempted. So we forcibly take control back from the thread to the CPU. Now, remember, not all operating systems provide, both of these. Some operating systems, like Windows 95 and so on, relied on voluntary operation. So you assume that people were going to be nice and give the CPU back. Question?
Is the CPU responsible for putting things to the screen?
That's a good question. Is the CPU responsible for putting things onto the screen? In a modern processor, screen display is usually handled by some graphics processor unit. In older hardware, the graphics might simply be a frame buffer, and you write bits, and those bits are directly appear on the screen, so there's really no intelligence in the pipeline. But ultimately, the CPU is responsible for putting things into something that then causes them to get displayed, whether it's a frame buffer or instructions given to a GPU. Any other questions? Okay, so let's talk about, we'll talk about internal events, then we'll talk about some of the external events. So internal events are things like blocking on I/O. So when I do a disk read or a disk write or I write to the network or I wait for a keyboard press or I wait for mouse input, these are all things where voluntarily I'm going to call the operating system and say, I want to wait for this to occur. My TCB will then get put onto a wait queue for that particular event that I'm waiting on, whether it's the disk or the network or the keyboard or the mouse or whatever. I could wait on another thread. Okay, so for example, if I want to have a thread that's going to sequentially print out the class list. So I might fork off a thread that that prints out section 1. When it finishes, then I print, fork off another thread to print out section 2, and so on. Well, I want to wait. I don't want to just fork all of those off and get a whole mismatch because I'm trying to separate out each separate printout. So I can have that main thread wait for each of the children threads to signal that they're done. And when they signal they're done, then I can start the next thread. So in this case, the TCB would then get put onto a wait queue for that other thread. When that thread exits, I'll then notify the thread that was waiting, or when it signals. And then a thread could actually be nice. So this is like, I think I used this example before, but you're in the supermarket and you see two people come up to cash register at the same time, and one person says to the other, you go first, and the other says, no, no, you go first, and they sit there going back and forth. Something that clearly doesn't happen in reality. But here what happens is the thread voluntarily says, I'm going to be nice, I'll give somebody else a shot at the CPU. So if I'm doing something computationally intensive, I'll say, okay, I've run for a while, somebody else can run if they're waiting. Yes?
So it sounds like each thread that gets created, a corresponding thread wait queue also gets created for that thread, and you
have
some other thread wants to wait on that thread?
Yes, implicitly. So when we create a thread, implicitly there is a thread wait queue that gets created. We don't necessarily have to instantiate it until someone actually goes to wait, but yes, logically there is a wait queue that exists for each thread. Yeah. So a thread only has one TCB in its lifetime. So the TCB then, you know, we copy the stuff out of the TCB into the CPU registers. It runs. When it's done running, we copy it back to the TCB and put it on a queue. Either it could be the ready queue or it could be a wait queue. Or it could be that it's terminated, so it's a termination queue. Yeah, question in the back? That's a good question. When the thread goes onto a wait queue, what is it waiting for? So it's waiting for typically some high-level event. So it could be I'm waiting for input characters. It wouldn't typically be I'm waiting for F8. It would typically be I'm waiting for input characters. Or it could be I'm waiting for a specific disk block. So in some cases, it would be something very specific. In other cases, it's just I'm waiting for some input. It's kind of a question of what the device supports. Yeah, question?
Is yielding something that's based on a timer or based on an event
or both? So yielding is voluntary. Yielding is not dependent on a timer. It's just simply I execute a yield instruction.
And that's just a spot like after I've done this procedure, I'm going to yield.
Right. That's correct. Any other questions? Okay, we'll actually go through an example of what yield looks like in kind of low-level detail. Okay, so this is an example of where, in fact, actually, I think yield's our next slide. So here's an example of how we might write the compute pi procedure if we're going to be nice. So we have our infinite loop, because it's going to take forever to print all the digits. We compute a digit, and then we yield. So what does this actually look like? So here's our stack. And stack is growing down. We compute pi called yield. That causes us to trap into the operating system to a function called kernel yield. And kernel yield will call another function called run new thread, which will then call the function called switch. Run new thread will help us select what to run next, and switch will actually perform that operation. Okay, so how do we run a new thread? Well, first thing we have to do is figure out what thread are we going to run. And we're just going to pick some new thread to run. Now, in reality, pick new thread will use our scheduler. So it'll be a question in the scheduler of who gets the CPU next. And we'll get that answer back. Now, once we have a thread to run, we're going to take and switch the processor from the current thread being loaded to having the new thread be loaded. And then there may be some housekeeping that we have to do. This is mainly to deal with thread startup and shutdown. We'll talk about that next lecture. Now, the question is, how do we actually make this switch occur? Right, now, this is where it gets really bizarre. Right? Because when we call into run new thread, and it calls switch, when we return out of switch, we're a different thread. So we'll go over that in more detail. But what's going to happen is we have to save anything that the next thread's going to trash. So what does that mean we have to save? Question? Yeah. Exactly. All of the thread's register file has to be saved. Now, obviously, we wouldn't have to save like register 0 if that's always 0. But anything else, we have to save those registers because a new thread might be using them in a different way. Yes, question?
So what happens when you have a dual point shift now?
Yeah, so if we have a dual core chip, then each of the cores would be running a separate kernel thread, or a separate physical thread, I should say. So each of the, if we have a dual core, we could schedule simultaneously two threads to run on it. If we have dual core with hyperthreading, like the Pentium 940D Extreme Edition, then each of those cores itself could have two threads. So it gets a little insane. So that's a good question. Are the threads responsible for saving things like K0 and K1? Yes, we have to save everything because we don't know what that other thread might have been, how that thread, when it called into the operating system was using K0 and K1 on its behalf. So anything that we can't guarantee is uniform across the thread has to be saved, especially when we go across process boundaries. Now, it might be that our discipline is such that K0 and K1 is the same for an entire process. Maybe there's only one kernel thread under all the multi-threads within a process. And so as a result, K0 and K1 would be unaffected. But if there are multiple kernel threads, then yes, they'd have to be saved. Yeah. So the question is in context of hyperthreading?
Yeah.
So in context of hyperthreading, how do we know what to save and what not to save? Depends on the hyperthreading implementation. Whether the hyperthreading actually has multiple register files. If it has multiple separate register files, then we might not need to save stuff. It all depends on how it actually works. Yeah.
With all these various implementations
to save details, does the guy that's running the program, do they have to recognize and kind of switch all these various different server intricacies? Yes, that's a good question. How much does the compiler have to know about this? Most architectures, it's completely hidden from the compiler. This is the operating system that's handling the switch. The operating system worries about what registers to save and restore. When you get into things like hyperthreading, then sometimes you have to have compiler knowledge because of the way that things work. When you get into multiple pipeline units and multiple logic units, also the compiler will get involved just so you can improve the parallelism that can be extracted out of the hardware. But the ideal situation is the compiler shouldn't have to know very much. This is all supposed to be transparent from the point of view of the thread. From the point of view of the thread, it's just running along. And whether it's running in parallel with other threads because it's on some dual core or hyper-threaded should be hidden from it, but isn't always hidden depending on the architecture. Was there another question? Yeah. That's a good question. Is the new thread the old thread sometimes? Yes. Yeah. Could be that you yield and there's nobody to yield to. So you get to run again. In which case you pick new thread probably has some extra logic in it to short circuit for those cases. Just picks you. Okay, so what do the stacks look like here? So let's consider the following code blocks. And let's say we have two threads, S and T. So we've got one which is procedure A calling B, the other is procedure B which is doing this infinite loop that yields. So let's say they're both running the same code. So what we'll see So in thread S, A will call B. B will be in the while loop. It'll call yield. Yield will call run new thread. And run new thread will pick a thread to run. It'll pick T. T's lucky day. And then we switch to T. So now if we look at stack for a thread T, it's going to look like this. Gee, it looks very similar. So what'll happen is switch will swap out the registers, swap the return program counter. Well, the return program counter now will point to run new thread, but for thread T, because we're now thread T. And then we'll return back to run new thread, return back to yield, return back to while. Okay. While loop will loop. It'll call yield. We'll call run new thread. It'll call switch. We'll swap out the state. Now we're finishing up this switch. We return to run new thread, return to yield, B, and we'll repeat. So we'll go back to yield and so on. So we're just going to sit going back and forth like that. Right? Everybody followed that, right? If I gave you a third thread, you'd be able to figure out what it would look like in terms of stack frames, right? Yeah. Yeah, that's correct. So in this case, the reason why we're returning into yield is because thread T called into the scheduler at the dispatcher from yield. Right? If this had been an interrupt, the stack would look different. Okay, other questions? Yes.
Even though the thread that's active is actually transitioned from thread S's point of view, it's been active the whole time. It just happened to call this.
That's right. Yes. So what's happening here is run new thread calls switch. Switch calls into this thing, and it just takes a long time to return. So from the point of view of the thread, thread S, it calls switch sometime later, 200 milliseconds later, it comes back. Right. And the way it came back is it came back via this switch. This is what makes switch weird, is you call in switch as thread S, and you return on the physical processor as thread T. But logically, thread S is just suspended. It's kind of in suspended animation. Then you run T, it suspends itself, and the next thing you know, the physical processor is running S again. Well, okay, so how would this run if thread T hadn't started yet? Well, thread T couldn't have called yield. So, in fact, thread T would be in thread root. So what would happen is we'd switch, and we'd end up in thread root. We'd start running thread root. We'll go through process creation, or thread creation, rather. We're kind of jumping ahead a little bit. Yeah. That's a very good question. Why, you know, aside from random acts of kindness, would yield decide in the middle of this loop to give up control? It could be for interactivity. So if you're familiar, there was recently a pretty severe Windows bug that was found in the Windows metafile format. Metafile format is basically a program for drawing pictures. And the idea is that since you can have devices of many different resolutions, from low-resolution screens to very high-resolution plotters and graphical output devices, the idea is rather than have a bitmap, which would be fixed at a given resolution, you use a program, which can have vector commands and other things like that. So this format dates back to like Windows 95 or maybe 3.1. I don't remember how far back it goes. And the idea was you would generate graphics like clip art and other things in this. That way, when you're rendering it on the screen, it looks nice. When you print it on the printer, it looks even better. When you print it on the photographic plotter, it looks even nicer. But when Windows was originally developed, you didn't have preemption. So to be nice, Windows Metafile actually included the ability to do a yield, to say, hey, do you want to get in? Do you want to abort this? And then, you know, it'd say, no, I don't want to abort this, and then it would keep processing the image generation. Well, it turns out you could use that to take over control of a machine. So that's an example of where cooperative processing is useful, where I want to get the user involved, or I want to, you know, check for some status having occurred. I can do a yield. Somebody else gets control of the processor and maybe terminates this or does something interesting. Okay. So context switch. Let's peel the covers back on switch, going from one thread to another. So this is what it's going to look like inside. We get called with the current thread control block and the new thread control block. And what we're going to do is we're going to unload the old registers. So here, in this case, this processor just has 8 registers. We're going to unload the stack pointer, and we're going to unload the return PC. Now we want to load and execute the new thread. So first thing we're going to do is load up all the registers, load the new stack pointer. So what this does now is it switches us from the old stack to the new stack, the new thread stack. And then we're going to change the return program counter, which is going to change where this procedure will return to. And then we just return. Okay, so when we came in to this, we had one stack, one program counter, one return PC. When we exit, we have a different stack, different program counter, different return PC. So we come in as one thread, we exit as a different thread. But not really, because we're exiting completely as a different thread, but we're still eventually going to exit as us when we come back to us. Yes? Yeah, so the question is there a concern about atomicity in this operation? This has to be done with interrupts disabled. Okay, so more details. How many registers do we have to save? Well, on some processors, like what you guys will be dealing with the MIPS 4000 series, we have to save 64. If we look at a Pentium, there's a 14 integer, 8 floating point, and 8 MMX registers we have to save. Spark has even more registers because they have these register windows for other things. Itanium has a lot of registers we have to save. I mean, there's always trade-offs. You know, more registers are nice because registers we access at chip speed, so in nanosecond time, a small number of nanosecond time, whereas going off to memory is much more expensive. The downside is when we context switch, all the state has to get saved. So what is this going to tell us in terms of how often we want a context switch? What's that? Right. The larger the register file, the less often we're going to want a context switch. Because if we look at an Itanium, we're unloading, you know, more than 270 registers each time. And loading 270 registers. And those are big registers because they're either 64 or 82 byte registers. Yeah. Yeah. So in fact, dividing up registers into sets is exactly what the Spark does in Windows. So when we're switching from one thread to another, the windows allow us to say we're going to have up to 8 threads, for example, running. And as long as we have those 8 running, we don't have to switch back and forth. But when we switch a process, all that has to get unloaded. All that has to get loaded again. So, you know, it's kind of cat in the hat-like. You know, we got the pile of dust, we sweep it under the rug, you know, but now we have a big pile. Yeah, so, I mean, we're just kind of shifting the problem from one place to another. Ultimately, we're going to have to swap registers. We either, you know, get the benefit of having lots of registers and few memory accesses, but then when we context switch, we have lots of memory accesses. So there's no way to avoid it, unfortunately. Yeah.
So I'm thinking I might be wrong here, but during the switch, during the switching process, don't we also have to switch the address translation tables?
Yes. So in this case, I was just talking about thread switch. If we also switch processes, then yes, all the MMU, memory management unit hardware has to get updated. You have to switch the pointers for the different address translation tables or segment registers or, you know, whatever we're using. Okay, so return PC is where we return to. We have to save that also. In reality, we're just going to returns typically implemented as a jump through register 31. There is a real implementation of switch and nachos. I don't actually know if we still have this code in the Java nachos. We certainly had it in the C nachos. But there's also examples of it in the book that show you how it works. Okay, so what happens if we make a mistake in implementing switch? Like, for example, suppose we don't save register R4. What's going to happen then? Weird things, right? You know, sometimes it'll run fine. I mean, it might run fine for weeks. And then, you know, right before you're about to submit at 11:59, bam, it crashes, erases your hard disk. All the data's gone. You know, so we're going to get really weird failures, and it's going to depend on the workload and the particular non-deterministic interleaving that's going to occur. So, you know, bad things will happen. Can we come up with a test? All right, so given that making a mistake is really bad, can we come up with some test that will guarantee we've got a good implementation of switch? Yeah. Right, so we could create two threads that kind of look to see, you know, write values into the registers and then get context switched and check to see the values actually match. The problem is we can't control when we get context switched. So we can't actually guarantee that we would test all the potential interleavings and usages of the registers. And this is one of the things, you know, when the hardware guys screw up on, you know, saving and restoring of registers, things break in very bizarre ways, and occasionally this happens, especially not so much with registers, but with flags, carry flags, or valid address flags, or not a number flags. Especially when you get into floating point, it's very hard to get the saving and restoring of internal floating point register state correct. So unfortunately, there's too many combinations, too many potential interleavings to actually guarantee you have it correct. So here's a cautionary tale. So Topaz, which was a system developed by the folks, I think it was at DexCerc, a systems research center down in Palo Alto, doesn't exist anymore because they're now part of Compaq, which is part of HP. They figured they could save a single instruction in switch for speed. By making a little change, and save a single instruction in switch. Now, does that really matter? Yeah, it depends on how much context switching. How much context switching do you do? You're calling switch, it turns out, you know, thousands of times, potentially a second. So it's probably quite useful to save cycles. I mean, when you start doing the math, you know, a penny here, a penny there, it adds up, you know, really quickly. So they did that. Now, it worked as long as the kernel was under a megabyte in size, because they basically didn't save part of a register, you know, or something like that. And so they save this extra instruction, but it only works for small kernels. So the kernel at the time was pretty tiny. And they documented it, because it's always important. Anytime you make assumptions, you have to document them. So they did. Well, time passes, people forget, and you never have an operating system that shrinks. They always grow, because you add features. Features are nice, you add more features. More features are great, you add more features. Keep going. And eventually, the kernel grows over a megabyte. What happens? Randomly starts breaking, okay, because this register now starts getting trashed. And it took a long time, you know, for them to debug it. Of course, you know, debug it, why do you have to debug it? It's carefully documented. But it took a while before they figured out why the machine was crashing. And the first thing you're not going to do is go and look at the switch procedure, right? Why would you ever go look at the switch procedure? This is a procedure that has run trillions of times without a bug. So it's the last possible place that you go to look for a bug. But in fact, it's where the documented bug is occurring. All right. Remember this when your code's not working. The thing that was working before, maybe the thing that broke. It's very hard to kind of get your mind around. It's been working for a long time, so therefore it should continue working, and yet it could be the cause of a failure. Ironically, you know, we're 20 years later from Challenger, and You know, the O-rings kept working, and so they didn't think there was a problem. Columbia, the same thing. Pieces of foam were breaking off. You know, it was not a problem. There are a few dings. We have to fix them. So you never know when, unfortunately, things are going to come back to bite you. So the moral here is design for simplicity. Okay. If you make an assumption that the kernel is never going to grow over a megabyte, it's an assumption that's likely at some point going to get violated, and someone's going to have forgotten that that assumption existed, and you know it's going to be a nightmare to fix it. Yeah. Oh, okay, so shouldn't switch throw an exception saying that, you know, the kernel's over a megabyte, but then I have to test for that, right? So I save myself an instruction, but now I got to add in, you know, 30 instructions to measure the size of the kernel. I mean, ideally, you'd like sanity checks like that, which, you know, there would be some check that when you build the kernel, you add a rule that says, you know, if the kernel's larger than a megabyte, then raise this exception. So, you know, people laugh, but you guys might remember the year 2000. So there were a lot of people. In fact, one of my friends, she wrote a program like 30 years ago. And she documented in it that, you know, this field is only two digits. And so, you know, year 2000, this is going to be a problem. And, you know, she put her name in it. Bad idea. Because 25 years after she wrote it, someone found her and said, fix your code. So it's good to document, but, you know, just don't put your name. I didn't say that. But you know, this is, in all seriousness, this is the problem. You know, when you're designing for ease, like two digits or save an instruction, eventually it'll come back and haunt you. Okay, so we'll take, actually we won't take a break because we got to keep going because we had a lot of questions, which actually was very good. All right, so what happens now when a thread blocks on I.O.? So let's say we're doing copying this file and do a read. So our stack is growing down. We're going to trap into the operating system and do a kernel read. Okay. Kernel read is then going to schedule the read to occur. So it'll put the you know, send the necessary instructions to the disk driver to tell it to load a block. And then we're going to wait. Okay. So it'll put us onto the wait queue for that device, for that block. And then we'll call run new thread and switch. Yes, question?
Does the kernel share the same stack space as the
program? Very good question. So does the kernel share the same stack as the program? It depends. Quite often, for very simple things, yes. For more complicated things, no. And as you design for security, it's actually better not to have the kernel share stack with the user. So typically what will happen is you'll, when you trap, you'll actually switch stacks, copy things over. But you kind of need both because stuff may have been put on the stack to pass to you. So the kernel actually has to be able to reach into the process's address space. If you pass a pointer to a buffer, for example, or you pass a buffer on the stack. Okay, so thread communication is also the same. If I want to do a signal and a join or I'm doing some networking, again, I'll trap into the operating system to wait, kernel wait on a particular thread, or kernel write to the network, or you know whatever the particular device is. Now, all of these things are good, but what happens if we have a program that doesn't do any I/O? Okay. Never waits and never yields control. So this is when we've got the person who's gotten control of that body, and we want to get them out of the body so we can have a different personality. Tired of talking to that personality. So, for example, if compute pi is running and we didn't put in that yield statement, then it's not doing, if all we're doing is computing the digits and not writing them, we're not doing any I.O. We're not doing anything that's going to block. We're just hammering the CPU. So we would never get control back. So what we can do is find a different way that the dispatcher can grab control back from the wayward process. And the answer is we're going to utilize external events. So it turns out that we don't actually have to do a wait or yield or whatever to generate an interrupt. There are going to be things like I.O. Interrupts. There'll be timer interrupts. There'll be all sorts of things that will cause us to go from running that program to jumping into the kernel and running some interrupt handler. So, for example, the timer is an alarm clock that we can set that goes off after so many milliseconds. It could be 10 milliseconds, 1 millisecond, 100 milliseconds. Depends on the architecture, speed of the processor, and the overhead that we want. There are other external events that might occur, like we might get packets from the network frequently, or we might get blocks in from the disk drive, or other kinds of, if a person's typing away on the keyboard, we're going to get keyboard interrupts. So we can leverage off of all of these. Like a network interrupt, for example, when it occurs, we're running some code, we get some external interrupt. First thing that happens is our pipeline gets flushed. So we squash anything that was pending in the pipeline. Then the dispatcher saves all of the internal state, and we jump into supervisor mode, raise the priority, re-enable interrupts, save registers, dispatch to the handler. Load the packet in from the network, into the kernel buffers, restore the registers, clear the current interrupt that just occurred, disable interrupts, restore the priority, and then restore from interrupt, which then sends us back into user mode, re-enables interrupts. Okay, we keep running. Okay, so an interrupt basically is a hardware-forced context switch. Right, so the hardware, unlike a software context switch, forces us to give up control of the processor and do something on it on its behalf. It's a separate step to decide what to do next. Now, typically what happens is there's some kind of table that says when we get this kind of interrupt, it's going to force us to jump to this particular handler. This is different from run new thread, which is going to select from the ready threads which thread to run. In this case, we're selecting from a handler to run. And then we run that handler. The other thing also is that this occurs immediately. So as soon as the interrupt occurs, we flush the pipeline and start running. Yes? Yeah, so I believe on the Alpha and some other RISC processors, there are these fuzzy interrupts where a hardware interrupt occurs and there's a lot of state in the processor, so there's some interleaving that occurs and uninterleaving to figure out exactly when the interrupt actually occurs. Okay, so here's an example of using the timer to basically force preemption of the processor. So we have a timer interrupt routine, and when the timer goes off, we're running some code, it's going to force us to jump to this handler for the timer interrupt, and that's going to run new thread. And that'll do a switch. So what this routine will actually do first is it'll do a little bit of housekeeping. So it might do some accounting and other things, and then it'll run the new thread. The I/O interrupt is the same thing. The only difference is this do periodic housekeeping gets replaced by some service I/O. So it could be get the block in from the drive or notify someone waiting on a write that it's completed, so on. All right, so now, question is, how do we actually choose what we're going to run next? Well, if there's zero ready threads, it's kind of easy. There's nothing to do. So typically what will happen is there'll be some idle thread. And in fact, if you look on Unix systems, on Windows systems, you'll see there's an idle thread. It doesn't actually run. It's just a placekeeper to say this is on the CPU. In fact, on modern, like on a laptop, what the idle thread does is when we go into idle mode, we power down the CPU. We turn off some of the, put the memory into a lower power state, power down parts of the CPU so we can conserve battery. If there's only one thread, what do? We pick it. Now, if there's multiple threads, then we have to pick which to run based on some priority algorithm. And there's lots of different priorities. It could be LIFO, the last thread that we put on, is the one we run next. It could be FIFO. It could be pick one at random. Or it could be some priority queue. And we'll talk about the pros and cons of each of these in the next couple lectures. So in summary, state of the thread is stored in the thread control block. It's all of the registers, it's the state information, it's the accounting information, it's the scheduling information. With multi-threading, we get the illusion of having multiple CPUs time multiplexed onto a single CPU. The switch routine, We have to watch it. You know, if we have an architecture where we have lots of processor registers, we have to save all of those registers potentially. So we get some performance benefits for a single thread, but it's very expensive to switch to multiple threads. Finally, there's the question of what do we run next? And that's what we're going to spend a lot of time on in the next couple lectures talking about.